Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Viglund. You know the saying, forewarned is forearmed? Well, in personal finance, sometimes you can be forewarned and it still doesn't do any good.
I've heard about this. I thought I was too smart to be caught in this. The first person I call, they said, I feel like an absolute idiot.
That's Narita Kucha with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. She says she got caught in a financial trap she thought she was wise to. What trap swallowed Narita? Was it A, signing onto a subprime loan she didn't know was subprime? Or was she hit with B, a huge default rate on all her credit cards just because she was late with payments on one of them? Or was she stuck with C, a costly plane ticket she can't exchange? Those fare restrictions can be sneaky. Okay, pencils down. Now stay tuned. The answer's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. The fix is in. The Bush administration outlined a plan this week to freeze some subprime mortgages before their rates reset. But will it really do anything to fix the housing mess? I'm Tess Viglund. This is Marketplace Mortgage. Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com. /retirement.
Well, we haven't changed the name of the show yet, but it was another big week in mortgage land. We learned foreclosure filings hit another record high in the third quarter, and President Bush announced his plan to get relief for homeowners facing the possibility of losing their homes.
We should not bail out lenders, real estate speculators, or those who made the reckless decision to buy a home they knew they could never afford. Yet there are some responsible homeowners who could avoid foreclosure with some assistance.
That assistance will come in the form of a 5-year interest rate freeze on some subprime loans. The freeze will not be available to borrowers who are already behind on their payments, and eligibility hinges on having at least 3% equity in your house, which could be tough in situations where borrowers put no money down and prices have fallen through the floor. For some perspective, we turn to our friend Nick Ritsinas at the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard. And Nick, the Treasury Secretary admitted this is no silver bullet. Is it even a tin one?
It is certainly a step in the right direction, but it's not a big step. This helps people who are current now have good credit scores and gives them some opportunity to avoid getting into trouble later. That's a good thing. But it's well short of the comprehensive plan that would address the serious problems that we have.
What's the main thing that this plan is missing then?
Well, part of it is the extent of coverage. What it's missing is sort of reaching down to people who are in trouble today. And what it doesn't do is really sort of stop the wave of foreclosures that is about to exacerbate what is already a very serious housing problem.
What's your take on some of the criticism that's been leveled over the last week or so as this plan has kind of trickled out, that it's really not fair to those people who got appropriate mortgages for themselves?
Well, they are limited to owner-occupants. So clearly, if this were a plan that would bail out investors, it's hard to imagine anybody supporting that. At the same time, the larger problem is one that affects lots of people, and it can be disruptive to the entire economy. So from my perspective, both of those justify a public policy intervention. My question is this a sufficient intervention?
What else would you like to see happen?
Well, I think they have to look at the issues of bankruptcy reform to find a way for people to sort of get out of this burden. We have to find a way to expedite short sales, that is, people able to sell their homes without carrying an extra burden. We have to make sure that there's money for counseling, and we have to make sure that there's money to help nonprofits help buy some of these foreclosed properties. And if we don't do that quickly, it's going to be hard to sort of keep up with the problem.
Well, in a speech this week, the president said, you know, this is what my administration is doing. And I urge Congress to take a look at other possible solutions, including perhaps some modifications at the IRS, where you are actually taxed if you do a short sale on your house. That's considered income. What's the likelihood that we'll get more action from Congress?
Very unlikely. This would have been a great request of Congress 60 days ago or 90 days ago. But at this point, Congress only has several more days before they go home. And if they go home without tackling this problem, I think they're going to get a lot of angry questions and questions that probably could be asked of the entire administration.
If indeed this Bush administration plan does really only helps a small slice of those who are having trouble with their mortgages, what does that portend for the overall economy? I mean, if all these people start going into bankruptcy and foreclosure, then this really hasn't done much to help the economy, has it?
Well, that is the bullet we have dodged. And again, this will help a little. But we're on the brink of a much more serious sort of economic problem. Every day as we look at these numbers, it becomes clearer and clearer that this will, in fact, lead to a much more serious recession.
Nick Ritsinas is director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Thanks so much, Nick, as always.
Thank you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
There's been a lot of finger wagging throughout this whole subprime mess. Many of you wrote to tell us that people who got bad mortgages should have been more careful, should have paid closer attention to the details. Well, there is always an argument for personal responsibility, but sometimes even the best intentions can go off the rails. Elisa Roth has this story about what to do if you're stuck with an ugly loan term.
Under the red and green glow of a season's greetings sign, two mechanical reindeer graze on the icy lawn of Narita Kucha's home in Queens. On the door hangs a wreath, and just inside is a carefully decorated Christmas tree. The festive decor masks Narita Kucha's anger.
I've heard about this. I thought I was too smart to be caught in this. The first person I called, they said, I feel like an absolute idiot. And I'm not. I'm a professional. I've worked all my life. I've done numbers. I was excellent in math. You know, I tweaked the math 100 times before I thought this would be a good idea.
This is a mortgage she got to refinance her house, a simple three-bedroom affair she shares with her husband, two grown children, and 3.5-year-old granddaughter. Okay. The retired nurse practitioner wasn't in any hurry to refinance the place, which she's owned for 27 years. But when a mortgage broker offered her 2.25% fixed, it was too good to pass up. Except when she got the first bill and realized the offer was terribly misleading, and her monthly payments had actually tripled.
At the end of the day, what's happening is these very nice, smooth-talking, clever, genteel salesmen are convincing people that this is the loan for you, and this is the way everybody's doing it.
John Taylor is president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, a nonprofit group that tries to bring private money to underserved communities. He says we shouldn't blame consumers like Kucha for their mistakes.
What's changed is not the ignorance or intelligence of the American public. It's the ethics of the mortgage lending industry.
Taylor says he's worried the president's new plan to help subprime buyers doesn't go far enough to curb questionable lending practices. And he thinks the administration's being too optimistic about how many people will be eligible for help under it. Housing advocates like Taylor say a big problem is a lot of people don't even realize their mortgage is going to reset. And that stack of papers you sign at the closing seems so permanent. Is there really anything to do if you find yourself with a less than ideal mortgage? Maybe. A lot of bad mortgages carry hefty penalties for paying them off early, and even if you feel like you were duped, if you signed the papers, you may be stuck. A good place to start is with a lawyer or local housing advocacy group to help you figure out the actual terms of your loan. Then you can try to get it rewritten.
People are encouraged very, very strongly to contact their mortgage servicer, the entity to which they make their mortgage payments.
Sarah Ludwig heads NEDAP, a New York nonprofit that focuses on economic issues.
It's sometimes very hard to get through to servicers, and not all servicers are going to take the call and work with the borrower. But the homeowner should try to get in touch with the servicer and say, look, I have a resetting mortgage, and please work with me to modify this loan.
She says many mainstream lenders are still willing to refinance in spite of all the talk about credit drying up. That's especially true for borrowers who should have qualified for prime loans to begin with. And Ludwig says some states have special funds designed to help people avoid foreclosure. As for Narita Kucha, she's trying to make an agreement with her lender. And angry as she is, she realizes she's one of the lucky ones. She only stands to lose a lot of money out of the deal, not her home. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. A couple of years ago, Congress gave tax credits to folks who made their homes more energy efficient. But all good things must come to an end. And now, if you were planning, say, new windows, well, you've got a window of about 3 weeks before those credits expire. Andrea Coombs writes for DowJonesMarketWatch.com. Andrea, those windows I mentioned, that's one of the potential tax savings until December 31st.
Exterior windows is one improvement you can make to your home. You have to get this sort of high-quality, energy-efficient window. If you install those, you can get a tax credit back. Now, this is the IRS, and nothing's all that simple anymore, or maybe it never was, but the maximum credit for windows is $200, but that is the total dollar credit you'll get back. Now, if you spend $200, you're only going to get 10% of that as a credit. So it's 10% of whatever you spend up to a maximum credit of $200. Another one is for furnaces and boilers. If you install approved sort of energy efficient furnace or boiler, you can get a credit up to $150.
All right. So we mentioned windows and furnaces. What about, for example, solar panels? That's been a big thing this year that people are talking about getting done.
That's true. And it's obviously is a big boon to your energy bill. And yes, there is quite a valuable credit, up to $2,000 available for installing approved solar panels. Of course, the cost is high. It's, you know, many thousands of dollars. You know, in your area, you should look around. Some cities are offering aid to homeowners who want to install solar. And there are also situations where homeowners are getting together and getting a bulk rate, a discounted rate from solar panel installers if a number of homeowners do it at once. And with energy efficiency overall, don't focus only on the federal tax credits available. There are many, many state programs. And the good news there is a lot of the state credits aren't expiring this year. So you might be able to get something next year if you're not ready to do this kind of, you know, major renovation in the next 3 weeks or so.
Well, we've gone through what's going on with the energy credits. Are there any other tax breaks that are set to expire at the end of this year?
There are. These include things like the deduction for teachers who pay for classroom materials out of pocket. It's up to $250 deduction. Also, there's an option right now where you can choose to deduct either your state income tax or state and local sales tax. It's more of an issue for people in states with no income tax. Tends to be a good perk for them, very valuable perk for them, though, for those people in those states. That we're still waiting to see whether that will be extended into 2008. Another one is this option to donate up to $100,000 out of your IRA tax-free. That's available to older people. People 70 and a half or older can donate up to $100,000 out of their IRA income tax-free to a charity. That expires at the end of 2007 as well, and we don't know whether that will be extended.
Andrea Coombs is a personal finance writer with MarketWatch. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you, Tess.
A first-time investor saw his mutual funds jump by 60% this year. Beginner's luck? Chris has an answer. And you want to be a cop? Are you sure?
I've been hit by cars at least 5 times.
A day in the work life of a homicide detective. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. Hollywood's writer's strike is in its 5th week. The Writers Guild says some progress is being made, but it's too early to tell how much. Meanwhile, some TV shows that stockpiled scripts are about to run out of them. CSI will air its last new episode this month, but some folks will still get plenty of CSI-style intrigue on the job. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we go on the beat with a homicide detective.
My name is Bill Zanton, and I'm a homicide detective in Washington, D.C.
Violent crime 69.
Violent crime 69.
I'm at 8th and H Northeast. Can you run a Maryland tag for me?
Go ahead.
I've been a police officer for 17 years. I've been a homicide detective for 5 years. When I was 12 years old, I bought my first police scanner and was constantly listening before I went to bed and was just fascinated by what was going on in the city. And it just, I could picture in my mind the car chases and the foot chases that these officers were going through based on what I was listening to on the radio. When people find out I'm a police officer, one of the first questions they ask is, have you ever shot anybody? And I don't know why that is. I guess they think that all police officers end up, you know, shooting people at some point in their careers, which is not entirely true. The typical day for me involves going to the United States Attorney's Office, which is the office here in D.C. that handles most homicide investigations. So we come down here every day, discuss our strategy, what witnesses we need to bring in. Right now I'm working midnight, so I got off this morning at 8 o'clock, went right to court, and we'll be down here in court probably till 5 or 6 tonight, and if I'm lucky, I can go home and get a couple of hours of sleep. For me as a detective, I think it's a little less dangerous than it is for the uniformed officer who's out there on the front lines. I usually tend to show up after the fact of a violent crime. My most dangerous times were when I was in uniform. I've been hit by cars at least 5 times trying to stop, usually drug buyers who panic when the police try and stop them. I've fallen through stairwells of abandoned houses. I've probably been to the police clinic for injuries at least 30 times. I watch Law & Order occasionally, and I actually enjoy the show, but it's completely unrealistic. They can identify people by their blood and their fingerprints within hours, and that's just not the case. Blood and DNA take months, if not years, to identify. And there's something called the CSI effect, which juries are now expecting things to happen with real-life cases the way they do on television, and it's just not possible. My base salary is about $75,000 a year. We also have the opportunity to work a lot of overtime, which can increase that figure dramatically. I think the best thing about this job is being able to bring closure to a victim's family and say, hey, we've made an arrest in this case, and the person who killed your loved one is going to be, you know, held accountable. That, to me, is the best part about this job.
We've got more about Bill Zanton's job on our website. It's marketplace.org. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
Tough alternatives bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, hard money mortgage. Hard money mortgages are loans funded not by banks, but by private groups. Usually, they're used by people who have no other options. But this option comes at a price. Fees and interest rates are higher than with traditional loans, and hard money lenders don't care about your credit history. They just want to make sure you're buying a valuable property. Because they foreclose sooner than banks do, and they want to make sure they get their money back. With subprimes all but dried up, many are turning to hard money loans, and that's a hard choice.
Got a box full of letters, thinking my life to read.
Well, it's that time on our show where we answer your questions. And with me, of course, is our financial expert and economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
How you doing, Tess? It's good to be with you again.
Oh, you as well. But before we get to the questions, we'd like everyone to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's go to caller number one. Andrew is with us from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
Please tell me that you don't spend all your money in the casinos there in Vegas.
Oh, no. You can't do that if you live here, in my opinion. You'll be broke.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that's not what you're calling us about. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm 25 years old. This is my first year investing, and I'm a software programmer.
So you've already started investing then?
Yeah, this is actually my first year. I currently have more debt, but I wanted to learn the ropes.
Well, so what's your question for Chris today?
Well, my mutual funds all together went up 60%. I was wondering if, you know, it's just the way the economy is right now, or if I can look forward to these types of returns later.
Well,
Chris, without getting into recommendations of which funds to invest in and which not, can you give him any advice?
Several things. First of all, 60% is terrific. Congratulations. In a sense, you won the lottery. The long-term average with the stock market, U.S. stock market, is about 10%. I'm curious, what type of mutual funds were you in?
I did foreign ones.
Yeah. Well, here's the trick. You were in the right place at the right time. If we were having this conversation back in the 1990s, the international stocks would have done very poorly relative to the U.S. And there are a lot of articles being written about, well, international diversification doesn't work. There's no reason to invest internationally. It's just going to drag down your returns. Oops. We get to the 2000s. And the international portfolios are the ones that are doing well. It's been hot for the last couple of years. But this is why I'm a big believer in diversification. I don't know how long it's going to last. I don't know at what point international stocks start underperforming the U.S. market. And that's why I would really argue very strongly for building a low-fee, well-diversified portfolio, and then take a little bit of your money and go ahead and say 10% and play around in where you think there's extra value. But because of this notion, you know, markets do well for some period of time, then they really cool off. At some point, the international will cool off, the U.S. will do better, and you want to make sure that you're well diversified so that you can catch that wave.
But Chris, he's only 25 years old, and at that point, isn't he allowed to be a little riskier in his investment choices?
He's allowed to be a little riskier in his investment choices, and I don't have any problem with him exposing themselves. But when we say riskier, that means a lot more stocks, right? I mean, that's one way to look at risk. There's another way to look at risk, which is I'm going to match my wits against the global capital markets, millions and millions of investors, some of the smartest people in the world. And, you know, that's a tough game, and that's a hard game to win.
How often should I cycle my assets?
You mean in terms of turning them over or getting in and out of funds?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you that except for when my employer has made me change my particular funds, I don't think I've essentially changed my funds for 25 years. They're low fee. They give me the exposure to the markets that I want.
Chris, is that what we call a lazy portfolio?
It's what you call a lazy portfolio. It's what you call a well-diversified portfolio. Think about it this way. Most professionally managed pension funds, like at companies like IBM, there's almost no turnover on the bulk of that portfolio for a long period of time because there's no benefit to doing a lot of trading. It can be fun, but it's hazardous to your wealth.
All right. Well, good luck, Andrew, and congratulations on starting to think about retirement at your young age. That's what everybody should do.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. And Chris, you know, I mentioned the lazy portfolios, and we've done quite a bit of coverage on that. So I would encourage folks to head on over to our website, and we'll have some links there to how you can design your own lazy portfolio. All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Beth writes in from Wichita, Kansas. She's trying to figure out one aspect of this whole housing fiasco. And she's hearing repeatedly that because of the subprime collapse, banks are losing massive amounts of money and face the potential to lose even more if more homeowners start to default on their loans. But her question is, how can the banks be losing all this money if they have possession of the homes when the homeowners foreclose. They haven't lost the money yet, right? They still own the home.
That's a really good question. And what it turns out is foreclosed homes typically go for a discount of about 20 to 25%. And that has to do with the lenders. They don't want to be in the homeownership business, so they typically want to get rid of it fairly quickly. 20-25% is a number we use looking at historic data. But we are in a period of record foreclosures. And so then I say, well, 20-25%, that would be under more normal conditions. We're in an abnormal state of the world, so you could be bidding 30-35%, and I don't think that'd be an unreasonable discount.
All right, so that certainly is bad news for the banks, and that's what we're hearing so much day in and day out these days.
Well, just one other thing. It's also bad news for other homeowners when you have a foreclosed home on the block. And imagine if you have two or three on the block. Then all of a sudden, people are looking at the neighborhood a little bit askance. They're wondering, you know, can I get a better deal? I can get this house for this cheap price. So it makes it harder for homeowners who have good financials to sell their home, in addition to the problems that are associated with that foreclosed home itself.
All right, Beth, great question. And I think something a lot of people have been confused about. Is there something about the financial news of the day that maybe you don't understand? Well, give us a call and we'll try to clear things up. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can email us by clicking on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org. All right, let's go to caller number two. Amy is with us from West Hollywood. Hey, Amy.
Hi.
So what do you do here in Los Angeles? Are you in the biz, as they say?
I am in the biz. I'm a line producer for G4 TV.
G4 TV, what's that?
It's video game and tech TV.
Ah, see, I'm not hip enough to know what G4 TV is. Chris, are you?
Well, I have to interject that I actually watch it a lot. Not because I choose to watch it, but my teenage son, when he comes home from school, it's one of the shows that he likes to watch. So I actually have seen it a fair amount.
Oh, come on, Chris. You're really into World of Warcraft, aren't you?
Oh, Halo 3. It's Halo 3.
Halo 3.
Halo 3.
I'm impressed that you guys know those names.
It's about all I know about them. So what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I'm always trying to get organized. My partner and I bought a condo last year, which is pretty expensive. So we're on a really tight budget right now, and I'm trying to keep track of where our money goes. But what I find is that we have so many transactions that whenever I try to catalog all our transactions, and I've tried using Quicken, and I tried another program at one point, what just happens is it overwhelms me. I get behind. I never really get a good picture.
Now, is this where you try to actually track like every penny that you spend?
Exactly. Yeah. And my purse fills up with receipts and I never enter them in. I just have all the receipts in plastic bags.
Yeah. You know, Chris, this is something that you hear a lot. You should spend a month or 3 months or whatever tracking every single penny that goes out the door. It's really hard.
I'm actually sort of anti-computer when it comes to creating a budget, mainly because I think it's too difficult. And also because I think it's slightly the wrong message. In terms of creating a budget, it's something you want to do for 2 or 3 months to get a good idea about where the money's going, what's coming in, what's going out. And then essentially what the job is to create some habits and also creating some automatic vehicles, which in today's world is very simple. I mean, you can have money going automatically into a savings account or into a money market mutual fund just out of your checking account. You can set that type of system up very easily. And again, it's one less thing to worry about, one less thing to be entering data on.
So, Amy, do you think that that gives you some idea of how to go about tracking it and how it might help you best?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Almost sounds like the more important, my partner and I talk about what we're spending every day and just to keep track of our habits, but not that we don't need to know exactly every little anomaly that happens.
Right. So, Amy, what I love is, you know, reporters have these notebooks that fit into easily into a purse or a pocket. And all you're going to do this is, you know, at the most 3 months, and then break down some of your consistent expenditures on a weekly basis. And then when you are actually at the stage where you're sort of deciding your budget, I'm a really big believer that for people who are trying to stick to a budget on their discretionary spending, to make it a, as much as possible, cash-only transactions. Because it's harder to spend cash than it is to use a credit card.
Well, I definitely have to think about that because I don't like to carry cash because then I feel like if I carry it, I'm going to spend it. If I have it in my pocket and somebody says, let's go get lunch, I think, oh, I have it in my pocket. I can go spend that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Amy.
Thank you.
Are you trying to sort out your finances but don't know exactly where to start? Well, give us a call. We'll help. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, let's reach into the email bag one more time, Chris. And Abby writes in from Centerville, Virginia. He's a nice guy, maybe a little too nice.
Okay.
Tried to help his brother-in-law, and now it's coming back to haunt him. Yes, lending to family, always a complicated risk. In 2004, he co-signed for a mortgage for his brother-in-law. First, everything was okay, but now he recently got a credit alert saying there are at least two past due payments. Uh-oh.
Oh, boy.
So he talked to his brother-in-law, and he admitted he was having some financial problems. So now the issue is it is affecting Abby's credit as well, and his wife is furious. So is it possible, number one, for him to take his name off the mortgage? He's done a little research, and he thinks maybe that might be something that he could do. He's also wondering maybe he could have his brother-in-law refinance the loan into his own name. What do you think of these options?
Okay. There's only two ways to get your name off the loan once you've co-signed, which is why I think people should not co-sign with the mortgage. One is, he's absolutely right, is his brother-in-law refinances.
Okay.
But my guess is if his brother-in-law is behind on his payments, the odds are he's not going to be able to refinance. But that is the cleanest and the best way to do it. So, yes, get your brother-in-law to try and refinance his loan. The other thing is you can contact the lender and say, you know what, I don't want to be co-signed on this loan anymore. Can you take me off? Now, it's up to the lender. They can take you off. But most of the time, they have no incentive to take you off. And if your brother-in-law is in financial trouble, they have every incentive to keep you on because now they have you on the hook if your brother-in-law falls behind even further on his payments. So I don't think that tactic is going to work. Try and get the brother-in-law to refinance. Otherwise, you're in bed, financial bed, with your brother-in-law.
Ouch. And that's going to stay on his credit for a long time, isn't it?
A long time. This is why you have to really think seriously about co-signing. I mean, there's lots of good reasons why people do it. And as you mentioned, Tess, it's family.
Yeah.
All right. And we all want to help out family. But I think there are other ways that you can help out family other than co-signing, because co-signing, there's a lot of risk, very little reward.
And very little control.
That's right.
All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but do leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. We spell that M-O-N-Y. Or visit our contact page on our website. We're at marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Coming up, a final visit with our Virginia Investment Club. The ladies have blown the doors off Wall Street, but there's always room for improvement.
Well, last month, I recommended we sell Turkcell. That was dumb.
And it's open enrollment season for Medicare Part D. Do you know what's happening with your prescription drug premiums? We do. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Back now to our investment club series. We're following three clubs, one in Seattle, another in San Jose, and a third in Fairfax, Virginia, as they figure out what stocks to buy, sell, and hold throughout the year.
The stock didn't do very well.
What sectors do you buy?
Prices are going to continue to go up.
Join the club.
We're back with formerly Baroque, 12 Virginia women who gather once a month on Saturday mornings to talk stocks, bonds, limit orders, and grandkids. In fact, at the meeting in November, club member Pat Meadows passed around photos of her newest grandchild.
Pictures?
Oh, look at this. Look at that face.
Janelle Usselman called the meeting to order.
Certainly have a quorum. Okay, and Tess, welcome.
Thank you.
We're glad to have you back.
Okay. These ladies have had quite a year on the stock market. Had I known back in January, I'd have invested right along with them. They started the year with almost $89,000 in the club account. at the end of October.
When Carol and I did this, we were at $137,879. Of the stocks that we currently hold, we had a 16.55% rate of return. I mean, that's what we were up. And of the stocks we sold for the year, we were up 11%. So that's pretty good. I think we did a great job.
Pretty good. Try fabulous. They did take their lumps at certain points in the year, but then rebounded. Maureen Anderson reviewed the club's performance since the last time I met with them in July. That was just as the credit crunch was hitting the headlines.
At our August meeting, we were down 10%. Okay. At our September meeting, we were up 7%. Our October meeting, we were up 14%.
November's market gyrations knocked them down a bit again, but the club will most certainly end 2007 with an overall gain of more than 10% on its investments. The S&P 500 has gained less than 6%. You may remember in previous episodes, we've followed their shares in Crocs, those madly popular but ugly plastic shoes. The club bought into the stock at about $24 a share in January. They sold it a couple of months ago using a stop-loss order. I asked Fran Betzner if that turned out to be a good move.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, yeah.
It hit around 65, and it's now 42, but it's been down to 38.
So had you not sold it, you'd be taking a real hit.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Okay.
Their profits on this one stock, $17,500. They've also done well on recent investments in Apple and an exchange-traded fund that gets them in on Brazil's economy. And then there's the Turkish cell phone company, Turkcell. Barbara Horn manages that stock holding for the club.
Well, last month, I recommended we sell Turkcell. That was dumb. Fortunately, I watched it, and we didn't sell. Every day, it's been inching up. At the last meeting, it was 21.07. Today, I have 27.50.
Yes.
We're at 50%. So we're going to hold it, and I think maybe we ought to consider buying a little more.
They've also dipped their toes into Google's boiling hot water. It's the most expensive stock they've ever bought. They only purchased 10 shares at $649 a share. But since this club is all about learning the ways of the market, they wanted to see what it was like to own a Wall Street superstar.
By the time it got to 741, Bobby and I are going, yes! I wish we'd bought 100 shares or would have been able to. And then, of course, it came back down, and then we're thinking, why did we only bought 10?
Yeah.
We're down 2%.
So what prompted you to buy it, and why now?
Everyone is always curious about our investment club. They're always asking me how we're doing. Do you own this? Several people had said, why don't you own Google? Well, it's too expensive. Well, it's too expensive now, but if it goes to $800 a share, then it's too expensive. So we had some cash at the meeting, and I said, I think it would be fun.
So next, will you be buying Berkshire Hathaway?
I don't think so.
If we could, we would.
Stay tuned.
If they do decide to invest in Berkshire Hathaway, they'll need $148,000 for one share. Meanwhile, the group voted to get rid of some of their underperforming stocks, and several members presented new stock recommendations that reflected their concerns about the economy.
Recession stocks are feel-better stocks, I think.
Mm-hmm. Comfort. Comfort foods, comfort stocks, yeah. Don't you think?
They voted to buy shares of traditional stalwarts, including McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and liquor giant Diageo. That last purchase wasn't without some reservation from several club members, including Maureen Anderson.
Yeah, it sounds great, but I just have a problem buying something that deals with liquor when I know so many families mm-hmm. that have been ruined by liquor, including my own.
After a lengthy discussion, the group took a vote.
On the table right now is a proposal to buy 100 shares of Diageo at approximately $89.30. All those in favor? All those opposed? Passes.
Well, before you adjourn, I want to thank you all for letting me sit in this year. It's been a pleasure. I think you're all just a delightful bunch. And thank you for letting us sit in.
Thank you.
I'm going to miss those gals. Next week, our final visit with the San Jose Group. We're looking for new clubs to follow in 2008. If you're willing to let us sit in on your meetings, go to marketplace.org and click on contact.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We talked earlier in the show about the looming deadline if you want to take advantage of certain energy-related tax credits. Well, if you're a senior citizen or permanently disabled, there's a far more important deadline to worry about. December 31st marks the end of open enrollment for Medicare Part D. And if you miss this one, you'll have a lot more than lumps of coal to worry about, even if you've been good all year. To help us figure it out, we turn to Kimberly Lankford. She's with Kiplinger's Magazine. Kimberly, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the real basics. Review for us, what is Medicare Part D and what's happening with it?
Well, Medicare Part D is the part of Medicare that now covers prescription drugs. For many, many years, people did not have prescription drug coverage through Medicare. So now people have many, many choices, and they need to make their decision for 2008 right now. They have till December 31st to decide which plan they'll have for the whole year of 2008.
What are the biggest considerations this year as opposed to any previous years? What's changed?
Well, the interesting thing is the most popular policies have increased their prices substantially, especially Humana and United Healthcare, the ones that most of the people are in. Some of the policies' prices have even doubled. So even though the average prices have only increased by about 14%, if you're in one of the more popular plans, it's really important to look at what your costs will be next year because you may want to change to a different policy. You may be able to save a lot of money by shopping around again.
I remember when Plan D first came out that there was a lot of confusion on the parts of seniors about how to even go about figuring out what plan is best for them. Have those details been kind of ironed out for them? Is it any easier these days?
It is still very complicated. I mean, that's one of the pros and cons to choice. The Medicare.gov website has a wonderful tool called the Prescription Drug Plan Finder. So if you are a person who uses the internet, then you can go on there, type in your specific prescriptions and the dosages, and you will see what your out-of-pocket costs, the premiums plus co-payments and deductibles, will be by the end of the year. So you can really compare those plans. But it's interesting. For some people, the price, the premiums, the higher premium policies may actually be a better deal for them by the end of the year just because of the way they cover drugs throughout the year.
How does that work?
Well, it's interesting. Some of the higher priced policies actually end up filling in the deductible and end up filling in part of that dreaded donut hole, that part in the middle where you have to pay a few thousand dollars out of your own pocket before you get the big coverage. And so you really need to look at your specific drugs and see what the co-payments are for them, how much that plan is charging you for that in order to figure out what the total prices are going to be for you.
So the dreaded donut hole is still there.
It is still there. And it is interesting because the people who don't have many prescription drugs don't need to worry about it as much as they do. There are some people who end up paying pretty high premiums in order to fill that donut hole. But you really need to look at what your drug costs are throughout the year. I mean, you have to have drug bills of more than $2,510 in order to reach that donut hole in 2008. For some people, they won't get there. But others with very expensive drugs, that could be a huge issue.
Okay. And again, the deadline is December 31st.
Yes, it is. People need to act soon.
All right. Kimberly Lankford is with Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine, and she's got a great article on Medicare Part D in the December issue. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, as you know, we have a weekly segment to answer your financial questions. Well, every month, we also have a letters segment for your comments about the show. So here we go. Our consumed special report brought a slew of comments, most of you grateful for our focus on consumerism and the trash problem it's exacerbated. Leela Heber listens to us in Tallahassee, Florida.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. This series on consumption is wonderful. If we all live more frugally, the demand for repair services, recycling services, etc., will increase. At the same time, the demand for other things will decline.
But a couple of weeks later, we aired a story about airline mileage runners who book flights with multiple connections to rack up frequent flyer miles. Peter Torkelson of Lanesboro, Minnesota writes, as a person who recognizes the global issues of wasteful consumption of limited resources and fossil fuel burning, I was truly embarrassed to have public radio broadcast such a story. Every passenger mile traveled adds to the problem. My recent interview with Harvard professor and author Elizabeth Warren hit a nerve in some quarters. Warren took mortgage brokers to task for their role in the subprime mess. Everett Ives lives in Austin, where he lobbies on behalf of the Texas Association of Mortgage Brokers.
Ms. Warren clearly has an axe to grind and was outselling her wares. The truth is, the mortgage meltdown was manufactured by the press and a few people with axes to grind. Foreclosures are not off the charts, and the negative press has created an environment where people with damaged credit can no longer finance a home. When you remove that large group of buyers from any market, you cause values to plummet, which is what has happened in the real estate market.
Lots of you wrote in with comments about our coverage of the housing crisis. Last week, Chris Farrell urged the government to move ahead with a freeze on mortgage interest resets. Richard Corcoran of Herndon, Virginia, thinks it's a bad idea. There are many would-be home buyers that recognize the housing prices had gotten seriously overinflated years ago, he writes. Many of us realized that we would not do ourselves any favors by entering a ballooning market. By preventing the at-risk homes from defaulting, it props up the prices. There are many people who want competitive damage to occur. Let them default. And finally, a response to my Thanksgiving weekend feature about home swapping. That's where you offer your house in exchange for using someone else's home for free in, say, Paris or Sydney. Kate Reardon of St. Paul, Minnesota, wondered who exactly this arrangement works for.
You focused on people who have fabulous 7-acre oceanside ranches. How do these programs work for people like me who are freezing in St. Paul, Minnesota, and would dearly love to swap with someone in Australia over Christmas and New Year's? Now that would be a story.
Keep those comments, compliments, criticisms, and questions coming. Go to Marketplace.org and click on Contact. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts
is
say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
looks like it's going to be the best
they
quarter.
They decide
for
what they're going to charge.
That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor Chris Farrell to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, it looks like we are forced once again to talk about credit cards.
Well, you know, Tess, a very smart boss of mine once quipped, "Personal finance has become getting out of credit card debt."
Sounds appropriate.
Doesn't it?
So Congress has been holding hearings all year, and there were new ones this past week with an eye toward making it a lot easier to get out of that debt. And the idea here is to curb all kinds of really questionable industry practices. You want to give us some details here?
All right. You want to get outraged?
I already am.
Okay. Well, how about the fact that issuers can raise your rates as high as 30%, even if you're current on all your bills, just because your credit score has declined?
Jeez.
And I'm not making this up. This is not Chris Farrell. This comes from the Government Accountability Office. So here's the straight story. These policies are hurting far too many consumers. The market works best when consumers are informed, not played for dupes with smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is these days.
Yeah,
you
that's
hear
right.
about these things that happen to consumers, and you just can't help but get mad, because even if you're a wonderful credit card user, you can still find yourself in big trouble. So let's talk about these hearings. Some of the big credit card issuers actually say that they're going to discontinue some of these practices. You believe them?
Oh, I do. They see the writing on the wall. The one that they're really running away from, this universal default. You know, let's say you have 3-4 credit cards and you're current on all of them. Your credit score declines, so they raise your rate. Or perhaps you start missing payments on one, but you're current on the others.
Right.
And all your credit card issuers raise you the 30%. That's loan shark rates. So they're walking away from that. I'm glad to see that they're doing it, but they really need to do a lot more.
You know, the Federal Reserve has talked also this year about overhauling some of the credit card disclosure problems that you have, like, you know, all that teeny, teeny, tiny fine print.
It's a 6-point font, isn't it? I think that's what they
something like that.
That they're using. You know, the Federal Reserve is making some progress. It's gotten a lot of comments. I mean, for example, what they want to impose is a 45-day notice before the penalty interest rate can be imposed. Now, what's interesting is some of the bankers, they don't like this rule. And what's really clear, the reason why they don't like the rule, is that gives somebody 45 days to shop around for a better rate. So I think it's a good move. Mm-hmm. I think the Fed has been asleep at the wheel. You know, where have they been the past couple of decades? But at least they are making some progress.
I want to ask you about one proposal that's come up. And we heard about it last week on the show a little bit from economist Bob Shiller. He is supporting this idea that's been proposed by Elizabeth Warren at Harvard Law School, something called a Financial Products Safety Commission. Do you think this would work?
I think it's a great idea. Look, it would make the information out there clear. It's based on an idea that a lot of the financial information, and you know this, is not just credit card companies, it's your insurance company, your mutual fund company. They've got all this information buried in the fine print. So what this commission would do is it look at it and say, okay, you can sell this, but we're going to require that the information be easily understandable by the average person. It's a little bit like the Securities and Exchange Commission. They say, got to publish the information, and then it's caveat emptor. Mm-hmm. What we're saying with a lot of these consumer products, you know, you can't understand the information, and therefore the market's not working, and the market is not competitive enough. I think it'd be a great idea, standardization, transparency. Boy, it'd be a great boon for the consumer.
All right, the straight story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, our San Jose Investment Club sprints away from the mortgage mess.
I'm scared of financial stocks right now.
Yes. Yeah, who isn't? So what are your financial hopes and resolutions for 2008? Well, leave a voicemail with your name, where you're calling from, and your resolutions at 877-275-6669. We'll air them on our first show in the new year. Again, that's 877-275-6669, and we'll post that number on our website. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, Michelle Phillippe, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. York. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.